Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
You know, somehow we've come to prize people who stick to their guns. But as Longfellow wrote, a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, and not wanting too little a mind, I've tried to remain open to changing my views, and in hopes of encouraging you to do that, here are 11 career-related issues on which I've changed my mind, and then after I trot them out, I will be inviting you to call in and agree, disagree, amplify. The first is networking. I used to entreat my clients to follow the conventional wisdom that ongoing networking is key to getting a good job and remaining well employed. But I've come to find that one size does not fit all. Some people have found networking well worth the time, but others not. For example, if you're a hotshot, employers are going to probably come to you with good work opportunities, so you probably have better things to do with your time than schmooze. Or you've networked a lot already and it's not yielded much benefit or pleasure over what you otherwise could be doing with the time. Now, sure, you might decide it's worth trying to improve your networking skills by reading up on it, or you might role-play networking situations with a friend you trust. What I really focus on now with my clients is to encourage people to use their track record to determine how much, if any, time to spend networking, and to decide what their best method is. Is it going to in-person events? Is it online events, participating in forums, like on LinkedIn or Yahoo or your professional association, or one-on-ones, inviting people for coffee, or even throwing parties? I now also recognize that this is just really blatant honesty, that some people just aren't sufficiently prepossessing and glib and likable to make networking worth a lot of time, especially if they don't enjoy it. And if people like that were to follow the standard admonition of network, 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 the likely result will probably just be more dispiritedness. It's better for those people to spend their time elsewhere. So that's something I've changed my mind about the ubiquitous recommendation that you got to network. Another thing that I've changed my mind about is something I've kind of learned from my millennial clients. A common dig on those millennials is they're unwilling to, quote, pay their dues. And I used to buy it, but on reflection, I think that not being willing to pay dues is often wise. Even just a few weeks of scut work is more likely to brand you as a low-level person than to be a launch pad to better work. A signal moment in my change of heart about this was with my daughter. After college, she got an internship in the Clinton White House, and her job was answering letters to Sox the cat, which was the Clinton's cat. And she asked her boss if she might get more responsibility, and she quickly became a researcher for Hillary. Yeah, it's just critical to ask for what you want, including a way to leapfrog dues paying. Of course, if you do have a better chance of leapfrogging, if you do a good job, you become well-liked, you show initiative, beyond the average, and all that. By the way, you know, I'm finding myself a little distracted, and I'm going to tell you why. I was listening to Philosophy Talk, great talk. It's like, what's going to happen when the robots take over, when there just simply is not enough work to go along? So I just want to make a parenthetical statement so I'm not distracted and go back. I think that it's right that, and it is going to be true, whether it be 20%, 30%, 50% of people will not find work, at least work that's sufficiently remunerative. And so what is the answer? We want certain things. These are not just luxuries, but we want to be able, if you are worried about getting a heart attack, taking a baby aspirin every day, some large number of people have to harvest the willow that makes an aspirin and extract the right ingredients and manufacture it and package it safely and ship it and drive it in a truck to where you're going to buy it and or sell it online. The issue that keeps when there's not enough work, the key is people need to be motivated by this intrinsic desire to serve. And that is the key. And there's going to be, all we saw during welfare reform, that unfortunately, when we expanded the welfare state, it merely resulted in many, many more people simply saying, great, I can now do sex, drugs, and rock and roll because somebody's paying my basic guaranteed basic income. So I think the key, ultimately, I think the goal is wise, a less money-driven, capitalism-driven society. But I think the path is going to be slow. It's going to require re-educating, to use the communist term, re-educating the public, starting in kindergarten, to recognize that one's worth on this earth is defined by contribution, and that dollars end up being a relatively shallow basis for that. And so when we get to the point where enough people are willing, like, you know, how many people write Amazon reviews without getting a penny because they feel they want to make a societal contribution? How many people volunteer, but it's not enough? And so it seems to me that the answer to the socialist ideal, the post-work ideal of community, that word was used 10,000 times in the last hour, is in long-term education. It ain't going to happen at once. But then again, the end of jobs isn't going to happen at once. But my take on this, for what it's worth, is that the answer is in mode. Before we give them a guaranteed basic income and expect them to be intrinsically motivated, that's not realistic. But I think if the culture, starting in preschool, starts to educate people about the wisdom of defining one's worth by contribution, not by pecuniary gain through money, I think that's the best answer. I might as well give out the phone number now. You can agree or disagree with that, as well as these career truths that I've come to believe are not so true. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now back to, now that I'm no longer distracted, I feel I've said my piece on that. I want to talk about some other career truths that I've come to believe are not so true. And one is LinkedIn. I had on this show, at the very beginning of when LinkedIn came about, I had Reid Hoffman, the founder. And initially, I kind of scoffed at LinkedIn. I told Reid Hoffman, I said, you know, most LinkedIn connections are wafer thin. Nobody's going to do anything to help somebody just because they're a LinkedIn connection. But I've been wrong. I am wrong. I've come to realize that with now 300 million people now on LinkedIn, it's usually possible to get at least, if not job leads, useful information on a prospective career or an employer. And in addition, a solid LinkedIn profile is now a must. So many employers troll LinkedIn to find the best suited applicants. And they especially troll the forums to find people who make smart comments. Such employers are trying to recruit people even if their LinkedIn profile doesn't say they're looking for work. Maybe especially. Most employers like what are called passive job seekers, people who are well-employed, who aren't looking for work. So I've completely changed my mind about the importance of LinkedIn. Next, the career of optometrist. I never even stopped to think about optometry as a career. It was for me like under the radar. But when I created the best career section on usnews.com, and I had to review hundreds of careers, and I came to assess optometry as a terrific career choice for a bright person who likes structure to work from. It's very structured. And you cure most patients, and the hours are regular. You get to be called the doctor, six-figure income, and the training is shorter than for a physician. Ain't going to get off short either. So I changed my mind about optometry. Conversely, however, I've become more disenchanted with the career of physician. I used to think the medical profession among the most desirable. After all, you help prevent and cure disease, sometimes save lives. But I have had a lot of physician clients, and frankly, especially since I've been 4 years ago, I started teaching at the UCSF Medical School, I've come to realize how challenging the medical profession is today and will likely become even more so. First of all, of course, getting into medical school requires a really hard set of undergraduate courses. It requires real-world medical experience while you're in college and a high MCAT score, the medical admissions exam. And even if you manage to defy the odds and get in, even at the public UCSF, 4 years of that really rigorous medical school is $300,000. And after that, you get a low pay, long hours, 2 to 5 year residency. And then when you've done all of that, doctors are spending an inordinate amount of time on paperwork, whether it be insurance company paperwork or Medicare, Medi-Cal paperwork. And they're pressured to see ever more patients per hour, not necessarily because they're trying to get rich. They got these huge student loans. And the reimbursement rates have really declined. Medicare reimbursement rates, insurance company rates. Now, no one's got a crystal ball, but I believe that the U.S. is headed, notwithstanding Donald Trump, towards single-payer system. And that's going to reduce physician salaries further. And in covering everyone, there are going to be many patients who are very frustrating, who have high needs, and are not very compliant. And so in toto, I've changed my mind about the physician career. I believe that many would-be physicians would be wise to consider some other career, or being a physician assistant or a nurse practitioner. They're going to be doing most of the doctoring in this single-payer environment. And those physician assistants and nurse practitioners get to do a lot of what the physicians do with far shorter training, far less expensive training, and they still earn six figures. So that's another thing I've changed my mind about. I want to give out the phone number. If you want to either agree, disagree, amplify these on any of these career truths that I've now come to think are not, or you want to opine about what I think the post-work world will be like and how we can avoid just massive social unrest, crime, and et cetera, and dissolution, with the idea that it's educating people long-term about the importance of justifying your existence, not by so much by money, but by this contribution issue, this societal contribution. Is that realistic? Is it BS? Whatever. Or if you can always call if you've got want to work over. That is, you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem. You're unemployed, or you're well-employed and still unhappy, facing retirement, just starting out. Don't know what to major in. Anything that's work-related, I can usually help. I call it a workover. The phone number for all those reasons here on Work with Marty and M. Cohen, KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. We've got a call on the line. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello, it's you.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm on the air.
You are.
Big fan. Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I've written a book about my life in the as a hotel concierge, and I have been trying to figure out how to get it published.
Mm-hmm.
I've looked on websites, and I've heard different things. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to get it copywritten first, because some people...
Don't worry about that. They're not going to steal your book. Don't worry about it. You automatically, I'm not a lawyer, but I believe that you automatically, as soon as a book becomes publicly posted, there's an automatic copyright. That's the least of your issues. The issue really is that it is extremely hard, if you want to get a book published, to do it on your own if you sound like you're a first-time author, so it's a book. The key is to get an agent. And this is a niche book. Maybe it's a book that would have such broad appeal about, the life lessons of from life about life that you learn from being a concierge. The first thing is to get an agent. And so there, if you Google the term literary agents, there are master lists of agents who are accepting unpublished authors. And then they also describe the kind of books they're looking for. And, we live in an era of specialization. So find an agent who would be interested in that kind, in a memoir, autobiography or career issues or whatever, and then write a query letter, not a proposal. There are also agents, like everybody is so busy, that you can't submit the whole thing. Submit a letter that's probably 300 or 400 words that makes the case for how well you write, how well this would fill at least a niche market, if not a broad market, and then send that to a half a dozen on-target agents, and that is your best step. And from there, if one of them takes you on for 15% typically, they will market it to appropriate publishers. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and so what about the idea of actually writing publishers directly.
No, that's what I'm saying. Today, when many years ago, they would take unsolicited manuscripts generally. Now they won't even look at them. They'll just shred them for a couple of reasons. One is that they need the agents to do the vetting for them, and they're too overwhelmed. You know, they get hundreds of, they would get hundreds or thousands of manuscripts. They wouldn't have time to do anything else. So they rely on the agents to do vetting for them. So no, that is not likely to work unless you have a particular in, or unless there's a particular publisher that is particularly interested in hotel workers or something similar. But statistically, your odds are better with going with an agent.
And what are the odds of being able to talk to a literary agent just as like an informational interview?
No, we're not good. It's a query. It's a query letter, as I said, that's impressive enough to make them want to pick up the phone to talk with you.
So when you say query letter, do you mean a letter saying, this is who I am, this is what I've done, and would you be interested in this?
The letter is something like, I have spent 32 years as a concierge, and I have learned a lot of surprising things that would certainly be of appeal to anybody who wanted to be in the hotel industry, but potentially far more broadly. For example, bullet, bullet, bullet. And if you would like to see sample material, I'd be delighted to send it to you, or I'd welcome a phone call to chat about it. That's the letter, that brief.
And when you say letter, is email acceptable?
Of course.
These days?
Email is only the only thing that's acceptable. In general, people, you know, email is standard communication. Now, there's no need to send it to snail mail.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. You're very welcome. Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemko. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hi.
I'd like to address paying dues.
Okay.
For millennials, it's not so much paying dues as learning the basics, and that's what I found them not to be willing to do as much, whether it's specifics with regard to work or how they interact with people. The expectation of superiority is pretty, it's a stereotype to be sure, but I think I wouldn't want to allow them to reframe paying one's learning the basics is paying one's dues. Now, that's my two cents.
That's an excellent amplification. Absolutely. There's a difference between paying dues as in licking envelopes, doing the Xeroxing, etc., as a way of paying your dues and staying in a low-level job where there isn't a lot of learning going on for 6 months, a year, 2 years. That's very different from what you say, which I completely endorse, that really when you graduate college or even your graduate degree, you don't know squat typically about how to be a successful professional, whether it be in the hard skills or in those soft skills about, you know, communication or leadership or whatever. And learning by watching, by doing, by trying out is absolutely not paying dues. That's really your career-specific career preparation, and I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, it also helps learn from mistakes that you make. So you
absolutely.
Well, thanks very much, Morgan.
And I thank you for the call. Appreciate it very much. I would welcome your call as well. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem you want me to solve, or you have a reaction to some of these career truths that I've come to think are not so true. What I really liked about that call wasn't it wasn't just agreeing or disagreeing, but he built on it, and he added a very important point. That I love that when the listeners do that. So anyway, the phone number for all those reasons here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. As I was saying, I've been talking about some career truths I've come to think are not so true, and another of that is about the career of lawyer. I have to admit that my early impression of lawyers came from TV. You know, those clever, dogged barristers fighting for justice while wearing fabulous suits. Well, my view on that started to change when I read surveys that found that a majority of lawyers were unhappy and wouldn't want their kids to become lawyers. I have a lot of unhappy lawyer clients. In fact, there's a statistical term called the mode. My most common client is unhappy lawyers. So that has completely solidified my changing of mind on the legal profession. Another thing I've changed my mind about a profession regarding careers is the career of medical researcher. For a long time, that was my career goal. But even in the vaunted fields of neuroscience and molecular and genomic biology, there is an oversupply of PhDs. And that's been true, frankly, for 20 years. Many of them have to take low-pay postdocs. That's after you get a doctorate, these $30,000 or $40,000 a year, postdocs being essentially the assistant to some big professor. And even after that, so many of these people have to forego their dream of working at a university or even in industry research to take some other job that's way further afield. Really, among my most vivid memories in my entire life is when I gave a career workshop at the Society for Neuroscience convention, and I expected maybe 25, 50 people. 500 showed up, most of them with a hard science PhD, who were looking for a job, looking for work. I've also been made more conscious of how slow progress medical research is. Even many scientists who are fortunate enough to be that big-shot principal investigator at university go through their entire career without a major discovery, let alone a breakthrough. Most of them make little incremental things, but they've worked a hell of a long time, a hell of a hard work, a hell of a hard slog, and can, in the end, have to rationalize their whole career by some relatively small discovery or some, you know, having closed many career doors. So while I used to tout medical research as a career, as I said, it was my number one plan. I wanted to study the biological basis of intelligence and that kind of thing. I no longer am as sanguine about it. Another thing I've changed my mind about is self-employment. My father was self-employed, so I was positively predisposed to it. But on learning the percentage of the self-employed and of startups, by the way, that go belly up, I started to have doubts. And those doubts have been confirmed by my clients' difficulty in achieving self-employment success. And now that I've reflected on it a lot, you need so many attributes. First, you do need this thing called a business sense. That ability to come up with an idea, it can be something you're copying, it doesn't have to be original, but discerning whether there is a need for another one of these kind of businesses or some brand new idea, figuring out will it sell, figuring out how to buy low and sell high. You need to be a great problem solver on the fly because you can't afford, unless you're rich or super well-funded, you can't afford to hire all the help you need to do everything. So you're part salesperson. You've got to have that ability to get people to like you and say yes. You've got to learn about sourcing. You've got to learn about nothing about bookkeeping, some IT, right? This is like a dirty, dark truth. It's the kind of thing we don't normally say in public. But really, to be a successful entrepreneur in general, you don't have to be unethical, but your ethics can't be too sanctimonious, because almost any salesperson, when they're trying to sell something, it's very unlikely that their product or service is the best and at the best price. And the really ethical person would say, you know, you really shouldn't buy from me. You really should go down the street or go on Amazon and buy it or whatever. But if you do that too much, you're going to be out of business. So you need to have ethics that are not too pure. So you could see why, and you got to be a self-starter. There's no boss cracking the whip. Sure, being self-employed enables you to instantly leap from schlepper to CEO, but very often it's a quick drop back to schlepper. So that's another issue on which I've changed my mind, the wonders of self-employment. I'll give out the phone number. Oh, I've got to call us online, so I'll give out the phone number anyway. If you have either, we want to react to some of these career truths that I've come to change my mind about, or you have a work-related problem, or you have a reaction to my notion that if in fact free market capitalism is doomed to failure, especially in the coming automation of more and more jobs, that the answer is long-term educating people to find their meaning of life as defined by contribution and relationships, creative outlets. I welcome your comment about that. All is a good reason to call or work with Marty Nemco and KLW. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Back to the phones. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, Marty. I'm meeting a friend for lunch, and she has had a really bad time the last maybe 12, 15 contracts she's done. They've let her go really quickly, days, okay, sometimes a week. And I wanted to sort of give her some advice. Maybe you should look at this particular aspect of of how you work or something, but I don't know where to start. And then if it seems pretty hopeless to keep, she's a technical writer, and and I didn't know whether to say, well, do you want to look at ghostwriting? I mean, so I, one of the two phases, like what she could do if this really doesn't work, or how she could look at what she's doing and maybe change some of that.
I love your call. Okay. Of course, you know, more unwanted negative advice given could alienate your friendship even if you're close. So what I would do is I say, you know, might it be helpful? I don't mind spending a little of our lunch doing this. Can we make a little chart? And the chart would be on the left side, would be all of those 10 jobs or 12 jobs on in column one. In column two, what you liked and did well at it, and what you didn't like or didn't do well at it. Filling in that, and maybe even before lunch, if you might invite her to do that at home, and then bring that as a topic of conversation, that would enable her on her own to identify her strengths, weaknesses, preferences, or whatever. And she could decide, you know what, screw it. I'm really a crappy tech writer. I hate it. I don't want anything to do with it. Or she could, in looking at it that systematically, she could identify some nuggets that would enable her to identify a more appropriate job within tech writing that she could then vet. Those could be lenses through which she views job ads, questions that she might ask in the interview process, so that her next time out, she's more likely to be successful. Or, as I said, she could say, screw it, this is not what I'm meant to do. Let's spend a part of our lunch chatting about what I love to do, what I'm good to do, and yet what's practical. Does that make sense?
Yes, I love it. I think she'll appreciate that. And then, do you think it's easy to get into, like, ghostwriting? Is that something that's
ghostwriting for, it normally is done for celebrities. And unless you've proven that you're a really good writer and critically an interviewer, you must know, ideally the best ghostwriters are people, well, there's a couple, well, I'll talk about two things. There's the celebrity kind and there's the business kind. The celebrity kind, you don't get to do that unless you're a well-published writer yourself and have a lot of track record that you can produce a full book-length, excellent book. You also need to be a great interviewer to tease out what makes great celebrity biographies is the ability to tease out integrity. Really what was going on in that person's life, heart, and mind. Not just the good stuff. There's a natural tendency for everybody to want to present their good side. Look at everybody's Facebook profile. Look at their Instagram. You think everybody's life is chirpy, perfect, chunky, hunky, dory, fine. And of course, what makes a good biography is the balance of the up and the down. So some demonstrated excellence in that interviewing. Now, the second category of ghostwriting is normally for poobahs. There are some people who have become leaders of nonprofits or companies who got there either because of their tech chops, their people skills, their charisma, but they ain't writers. And so when it comes time to giving a talk that motivates the troops to raise more money for, you know, saving the whales, or it's a company that's trying to flog their sales force into selling more cardboard boxes or whatever, they need somebody who's a speechwriter or somebody who's going to write copy that goes on the website, the letter to the shareholders, and that requires samples. If your person's a tech writer, he or she would have to write samples of awesome kinds of those kind of communications. And again, a lot of ghostwriting is done by speechwriters. You know, President Obama or President Trump did not write their own speeches. They have some smart writing person who's also marketing oriented, who knows the right catchphrases that are going to get people to say, yes, I love Obama, I love Trump, to do that. So that's the world's shortest course in being a ghostwriter for either celebrities or leaders. What's your reaction to any of that?
Yeah, I think that's probably not a good course. I think she needs to reanalyze what went wrong and what went right and try to go with that. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And again, those are not the only options in the world. One of the nicest things about my career as a career counselor is there are thousands of careers and there are millions of variants. I want to tell you, and it's not just for you, this is probably not relevant to you, but for the listeners, and before you go, I might as well just share it. I had a client yesterday who wanted to be in the wine industry, but all he could think about was selling wine. He loves France, and he thought about selling wine or importing wine. I said, there are so many jobs within the wine industry, everything from yes, selling wine, but not to restaurants or to stores, but to the airlines. I know somebody who runs a business that simply imports and checks out wines and sells them to the airline industry. I know. Then there's everything from the bottle, the capsule. The capsule is the lead and metal top that is beautifully embossed that goes over the cork. There are businesses that do that. There are cork manufacturers. There are people who plastic corks have become dominant here and screw tops here, but not in other countries. What about selling or importing wine to rich? You know, there are rich people even in underserved, let's call them low-income places like Lagos, Nigeria. You know, do you want to look at what the market is there? I had a client who was a wine bottle photographer. You know, red wine just looks like it was in, like it's black, but to create just enough light that goes through it so it has this nice dark red through it. There's shipping. There are wine people. There are wineries who love to make wine, but they don't know. You know, they don't give a crap about shipping it. And there are all these new rules about shipping. This is when the law changed so that California wineries could sell out of state. You know, companies that specialize in shipping inexpensively and temperature controls and whatever. The point is that in every field, there are thousands of under-the-radar opportunities, and I encourage you with your lunch, if she decides she wants to get out of tech writing, the option is the only ghostwriting is not the only other option. There are 1,000 variants on every imaginable field. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you. I'll certainly engage her in that. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Take care. We've got all our lines lighted up, but I want to, I always hate when I promise you something and then I don't fully deliver. I've been talking about career truths I've come not to think are so true, and I've got a few more that I want to share, and then we'll go right back to the phones. Thank you, by the way, all of you for your patience who are waiting online. We'll get to you in just a minute or two. Something I used to think was wonderful, like most people, working at a startup. It's got so much good press. Hey, foosball, ping pong, frisbee. Hey, massages, free Red Bull in the fridge. It sounded almost like summer camp. But I've come to learn that the fun stuff is often dwarfed by the chaotic, underfunded realities of most startups. Most startups, they're really disorganized. And before they get organized, they're out of business. It's not fun. In contrast, most of my clients are finding greater satisfaction working for well-established companies or nonprofits, those that have had the time and money to work out the kinks and to afford to pay people well and provide nice workplaces, and therefore they can attract good talent, which makes your work in there more pleasurable. So I've changed my mind about working at the joys of working at a startup. Another thing I've softened on this one, which is tough negotiating. I grew up in New York City, where the culture values tough negotiation. But my clients in general have found that a moderate win-win approach to negotiation generally is wiser. You may or may not squeeze out every last dollar, but most times, fighting past that first round or two is more likely to just annoy the person, maybe even get the job offer withdrawn, than getting any after-tax amount of money that's worth fighting over. Because if they offered you 75 and you want 85, that top 10,000, the difference between 75 and 85 is going to be taxed at your top rate. Federal, state, local, FICA, Social Security, Medicare, Medi-Cal, workers' comp. It's not worth that fight over that what after taxes will probably be $5,000, which is $600 a month. More than that, it's $400. Less than that, it's $400 a month. That's not going to change your lifestyle a whole lot. So I've changed my mind about negotiation. And last, college and graduate degrees. I mean, I've consumed a lot of education. And if only because of cognitive dissonance, you know, not wanting to devalue what you've put so much effort in, I can't help but value it. But as the decades have gone by, and especially since colleges and graduate schools are now willing to accept students with academic records that they previously would have rejected, I've developed grave doubts. Not only has the pervasiveness of degree holders made that sheepskin a mere license for getting a job, like a job hunting license, there have been major studies, notably one called Academically Adrift, that find a remarkable percentage of graduates grow very little, if at all, in the crucial things that even colleges trumpet that they say we're supposed to get out of it, critical thinking, writing, and those are the graduates. Nationwide, only 59% do graduate with an undergraduate degree, even if they're given 6 years. And then, of course, there's the mountain of student debt. So I have become more of a fan of what I call degree-free learning. That is self-study augmented by a mentor, a tutor, selected courses that are really great, not just the one that the college you happen to be attending, but any, and of course the free and low-cost ones that are on Udemy or Lynda, L-Y-N-D-A, that's the new online practical courses offered through LinkedIn, or if you're a techie person, Udacity, or if you're looking for more academic courses, there, you know, it's amazing at Harvard and Yale, they offer, and at Stanford and Berkeley, they offer free online or very low online courses, which you can, we're all aggregated at these two great websites, Coursera.org and edX.org. And then, having gotten your learning at this what I call U University or UU, you can actually make a better case to employers that you've learned more of practical value using that combination of things than if you had gotten your standard highly expensive degree, master's degree in business, nonprofit management, or whatever. So I've changed my mind about that. So in summary, I've changed my views about networking. It's only right for some people. Paying dues, yes, it's perfectly fine to have an entry-level job where you're learning skills, but doing a lot of literally or metaphorically envelope licking is not something that you need to do. LinkedIn, I really think it's now invaluable. I've gotten much more optimistic about the career of optometrist and audiologist, and more pessimistic about the careers of physician, lawyer, and medical researcher. More pessimistic about self-employment. Not as enthusiastic about working in a startup. I've changed my mind about tough negotiation, much more in favor of moderate negotiation, and I've become much more a fan of trying to get your career preparation and training outside of the hall of academe. And now I won't give out the phone number because I've got too many lines lighted up here. So let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. Thank you for your patience. What is on your mind?
Good morning, Marty. I haven't called in a long time.
Well, glad to have you back.
Thank you. I'm a just retired. I am a former nurse's assistant. I worked at a veterans hospital. I'm a veteran myself, and I'm also an artist.
And you have a great voice on the radio. You have a soothing voice, my God. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. What I want to bring up here, since you often mention artists and artistic people, is some advice for artists from somebody who is an artist himself. And I'll be very brief.
Please, go ahead.
The first thing you should do is don't go to art school.
Right.
They're expensive.
Ridiculous.
They're, in fact, unbelievably expensive.
Right, unbelievable, like $100,000 to $150,000 for art school.
Right. And then what I would suggest instead is that you go to, if you need to build your foundations, is go to a junior college or a state college instead.
Right.
It's much more economical, and in many ways, they have some very good people
in
their art department.
Especially in the Bay Area, where so many artists love to teach, and so those community colleges, for example, can get awesome art teachers. I couldn't agree more. Continue.
Right. The second thing is, also, find artists that specialize in your particular kind of art and get instruction from them one-on-one.
Love it.
Many artists have ateliers and personal instruction. I got my best instruction from that particular venue.
Right. Right.
The other thing I'd like to point out is that find yourself another way to pay your bills. Get yourself some kind of job where you have flexible hours or some other kind of working arrangement where you can have as much time in your studio, because the cold hard fact of life is that 90% of people who are artists get their income from other sources.
Right. And of course, we all have this, most everybody has a desire to create something, whether it be through music or art or juggling or magic. We want to do something creative and expressive. But because of that, there's so many people wanting to do it, you can't expect to make a living at it. And you're right. I mean, whether it be the time-honored waiter job or whatever, but not Uber. Uber is a real ripoff, because the cost of driving that car of yours, in terms of the wear and tear in the car, the maintenance, the insurance, the gas, or whatever, usually is about a break even. That's not a good job. I like waiter jobs because you can make good money. It's not stressful. You got regular hours, and the tips are really quite good. It's not, you're not going to be making 10 or 15 bucks an hour as a good waiter, or work for a friend where they're not going to treat you like a wage slave and treat you like crap. I couldn't agree with you more. So you worked as a medical assistant. I'm sorry, what?
Real artists have day jobs.
Real artists, I love that. And so you worked as a medical assistant. Let me ask you one question about that life. Now, when I think of medical, I'm always trying to learn more about a career. Here's what I think of it. I think of it as $18 an hour, taking blood pressure, weight, and that kind of thing. Is it? Tell me something that might surprise me about being a medical assistant.
Well, one of the things about it is that the hours can be flexible. And that's the thing, is that your time in the studio is important. Some people work various shifts. Some people work swing shifts, some people work night shift. And, you know, because of the flexibility of hours, I find that you actually can have a lot more time in your studio than most others, because that's the real battle that you're fighting, a battle for your time. And I would also say another piece of advice is you're going to have to sacrifice if you're going to be an artist. And, in fact, my advice to every artist is throw away your television.
I think that's a great point. I think that's all good. You know, you are an honored member. I'm so glad you've decided to rejoin me here on Work with Marty Nemco, and thank you very much for the call.
Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you. Okay. By the way, while we do have lines lighted up, I want to. I had an old-fashioned listener, a guy who wrote me simply a standard mail in the U.S. mail, and he said he likes to hear success stories, and so I want to. Make a special call out to you. His name, he doesn't give his full name. He just says Pavelski. He signs it J-P-A-V-E-L-S-K-I. If you have a success story in your work life, maybe you've been a long-term unemployed person who's gotten a good job and done well, or maybe you made a radical career change that's worked out really well, I want to make a special shout out to, or at least call out, to any of you who'd like to share your success story. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And back to the phones. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, this is Don.
Hello, Don.
I'm calling for my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
She's an 18-year-old June graduate of high school.
Okay.
She was a special ed student.
Uh-huh.
She was on an IEP.
Yep. For those who don't know, an IEP is an individualized education plan. It's a very specific plan for what teachers are required to do and others, if speech therapists or whatever, to meet her individual needs. Go ahead.
Yeah. So she has trouble with traditional learning and analyzing concepts.
Okay.
So, you know, we're in the midst of trying to figure out goals and next steps for her now. One thing she did not take in high school were standard college prep English courses.
Uh-huh.
And we would like to get her up to speed on just, you know, English concepts, high school English courses. And that's, you know, so I've looked online to say, high school online courses, and they're pretty reasonable, like $270.
I'm going to interrupt you. I normally believe in building on strengths rather than remediating weaknesses. The first word you said to describe her, she's bad at analyzing concepts. Well, most standard high school English courses are all about analyzing concepts. You read Shakespeare and analyze it. You go and you read an expository essay and analyze it. I want to start our conversation by your telling me not what her disabilities are, but what is she best at?
Favorite and best classes in high school were concert orchestra.
Uh-huh.
And chamber orchestra, which required an audition, and she plays violin.
Okay.
Her favorite class was Mandarin Chinese. She took 4 years of Mandarin Chinese.
Okay. So,
but you see, both those things you learn a little differently.
Okay. How good is her Mandarin?
I think since she likes art, drawing the characters, very good. Probably accent is good, but saying a full sentence, if asked a question, and responding in a sentence for a conversation, not so good.
Okay, so here is where my first start would be. This is only a starting place, but it's a smart path relative to what you've told me. If she's good at drawing Mandarin characters, there are people who do calligraphy for various art. They don't just use something that comes off the internet. I'm sure there's obviously computerized. But if she's at all good at it, maybe she could enhance her skills by developing the artistic versions of this. Now, I'm trying to merge some things. It seems absurd, but there are concerts, for example, in which the program might have the cover of the program might be, say it's a concert of Asian music. I mean, I just saw, for example, Xinhua or whatever they're doing, this big thing that comes to the Bay Area every year. What if she became an expert at artistic drawing Chinese characters and then focused whatever efforts to get hired at Asian music-related entities to see if, in fact, that she could get hired to create, whether it be CD covers, music websites, concert programs, fundraising letters, whatever. That would seem to build on her music, classical music love, as well as her interest in Mandarin and her particular strength in that drawing characters. And just like that wonderful previous caller said, what she should do if she wants to do that is find somebody who is a master at creating wonderful Chinese characters, an artist, and be mentored by her or him. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, and one of the ideas that she and I have discussed, we thought I'd get her a Mandarin tutor to continue with her Mandarin, because there's no Mandarin classes. We live.
Don't focus on the language. We want to be a little more focused than that. If she's not conceptual, she won't even be a good translator, because a translator would require understanding of really the nuances in the language. And she's not that analytical. And you say even when she has to say a whole sentence in Mandarin, that's too big a mountain to climb, especially for special needs kids. Build on what naturally she's good at and passionate about. I would go away from the verbal analytical and rather the artistic creating of beautiful kanji characters. What do you think?
I think that's an excellent idea, but I'd like to toss to you where her goal might be.
Okay, please.
And that is... And I've modified it for, because I know about colleges and stuff, a 2-year associate degree in theater arts. She has a...
I don't like it. I'm going to interrupt you. Nope. Again, that, you know, when you take it, it's like I'm terrible at fixing anything. And so if you enroll me, you could enroll me in a 1-year, in a 2-year, or 1-day, or a 9-year course in fixing or engineering or whatever, and I will fail. You sound, you know, you're verbal. You've got this kind of middle-class, verbal, academic mindset. You've told me after 12 years of school that she's still in special ed and bad at analysis. Putting her in another academic environment is setting her up for failure. I'm trying to put her in an environment where she's more likely to succeed. Does that make sense?
Makes a lot of sense. Okay.
And I think for today, I think that's where we need to stop, because I've got other calls and I do want to get to them. But that's my take. Build on the strengths. You know, I can't imagine how frustrating it must be for her. We live in a society where these white-collar, academic, intellectual, analytical, verbal, written skills are so prized. She's now gone through 12 years of that and not succeeding at that. And now her daddy is telling her, go do more? No. We've got to put her in a place where, you know, track record matters. And
right.
So we just can't act in some fantasy land of what we wish our kid would be. We've got to build on that. We've got a great track. By the time she's finished high school, we have a great track record. We've got to build on. If you really love her, you need to abandon your own values about what you think is important in favor of what would enable her to flower as she is meant to flower. Am I being too harsh, or does that feel reasonable?
It's fairly reasonable. The only change I might want to say, the theater arts was really her idea, wanting to act.
But she may not, to act, but most of the theater major, even in a 2-year program, is going to be analyzing theater. She's going to have to read a ton of plays, analyze them, write essays analyzing them, or she won't get, you know, it's one thing to want to act, but that's not what the major is. She wants to act? Fine. As part of her life, she can work at the community theaters are always looking for actors, at least for small roles. She can scratch that acting itch without having to focus so much on the intellectual and analytical and reading-centric that is in her strength. Make sense?
That's an excellent point about trying to find plays in the area.
Absolutely.
That have a tiny role for her.
Yeah, for starters. It may stay as tiny. My wife, you know, loves big roles. My wife, you know, does a lot of acting. She's a superintendent of schools in Napa County, but she finds time to do these acting roles because it enriches her life. And I certainly want your daughter's life to not just be defined by a career. We should all have good avocational interests. And if theater is one of them, awesome. Let her go and do some of that in community theater.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. I want to serve you. We'll take one more call. So welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello? It's you.
Oh.
Hi.
Hi. I want to talk about the internet and about YouTube.
Okay.
And about, I'm a guitar teacher.
Okay.
And on YouTube, there's so many free, everybody's offering free lessons.
Right.
And I think it's really affected my business.
Of course. You know, so many, look, I love to write Amazon reviews because I feel like when I write an Amazon review, I can give my honest experience with a product and help a lot of people. Do I get paid? Of course not. You know, in journalism used to be a paying career, but because we in the schools have done such a good job of talking about the importance of changing the world, we have a zillion citizen journalists who are willing to work for nothing. Look, I've been doing this radio show 28 years. I don't get paid a dime. I've written 20 essays for Time magazine in their prestigious ideas section. I haven't gotten paid a dime, even though I'm not shy about negotiating. You know, that's just, you know, and music and art and all that is just intrinsically fun. And so, you know, there are people now get paid mainly to do work that isn't that much fun, like sitting in front of a spreadsheet all day or cleaning up your collecting your garbage. But music teaching, it's just too fun. And so, yes, the wages are going to come down. And at least, you know, that either's got to motivate you to treat it as a hobby or decide that what you're going to put on the internet, that free lesson, is so awesome that it makes somebody say, you know I could get free lessons, but this teacher is so good that I'm willing to pay $30 or $40 an hour to get taught. Now, if you were to be honestly looking at yourself, which of those three feels like you? Should you simply make it a hobby and just expect that you're not going to make much money from it? B, do you need to put a better free lesson on the internet? And C, do you need to up your game in terms of how well you teach?
Well, I get excellent reviews. I mean, I get 5-star reviews.
Great.
I've been teaching a long time. I've studied with a lot of famous people, and so the people that know me and my reputation, they have no problem paying.
Okay,
know,
great. Then forget the internet. What you need to do is when you're doing it a long time and you're getting 5-star reviews, the single most potent way to get more paying clients is to make a list of all of your satisfied clients and either send them a newsletter or a special offer or a thank you, or pick up the phone and not solicit business, but do a call to find. You know, I was just, you popped into my head, Mary, and I was thinking about those lessons we had in you know, going beyond the basic four changes and, you know, working on improvisation. And I was curious how you're doing. And you don't ask for anything, but simply by showing that interest, if you make 10 or 20 of those calls, one or two or three, as Mark said, oh, I'm really kind of glad you called. I could really use some more lessons. Or, you know, I've got a friend who's looking to play guitar. That's the best way to get new clients is old clients. Make sense?
Yep, absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Okay, you bet.
Okay, we only have a few minutes left, so I think what I want to do is, rather than give out the phone number again, I think I'm just going to share some tweets. Those of you listening to the show know I love to tweet because I consider it a repository of my best ideas, and I'm forced to be concise. And that's a good thing to do on this radio show when I've got just a couple of minutes and I need to fill a little time. So here are some of my more recent career-related tweets. Be competent and beloved. For example, a foreman found a dead bird on a chocolate factory floor. He took a selfie with the dead bird and posted it in the break room with a caption underneath saying, "Our newest chocolate filling." Now, the workers were afraid he was going to be furious at them for allowing a dead bird on the floor, but by having the perspective to make light of it, he wasn't tolerating low performance. He became not only competent, but beloved. So I've expanded a bit on the tweet, but that was basically the tweet. Another tweet. This is a quote from a guy who's an artist, an eminent artist and photographer. His name is Chuck Close. His quote is, "Inspiration is for amateurs. The rest of us just show up and get to work." It's kind of like what the previous caller was saying. Real artists have a day job. Another career-related tweet. this one from, despite my being an atheist, this one comes from Norman Vincent Peale. Happy people broke procrastination's chains to find satisfaction in the job at hand. You can too. Another quote, this is another one, not my own idea. This was something that's from Andrew Carnegie, the capitalist industrialist. The quote is, people unable to motivate themselves must be content with mediocrity, no matter how impressive their talents. It's true. There's a lot of people, we all know brilliant failures, a lot of people with talent, but who it goes unrealized. Another couple of tweets. In the year 2008, 66% of employers uncovered a lie or misrepresentation on a resume. In 2017, that 66% had grown to 85% in just less than a decade. Employers, therefore, are verifying much more of what is in resumes, and job seekers beware. Next tweet, in response to that, there is a website now, a company on the web called Beamery, B-E-A-M, like in light beam, Beamery, E-R-Y, Beamery. It now enables employers to recruit the people it wants and not rely on applicants at all. They troll LinkedIn forums, Yahoo forums, other sources of people who are demonstrating a great deal of competence without being looking for a job. And final, another tweet is, this came from Baudelaire. His quote is, how many years it takes to learn the simple truth that work, that disagreeable thing, is the only way to not suffer in life. That's the end quote. That's rather the opposite of the contention that was that I've been making about work and the end of work and what was said in a philosophy talk the previous. And I got time for one more. New managers and leaders, whether for-profit or nonprofit, ask employees, what are three things we have to change? What are three things we have to keep? What do you most want me to do? And what are you most afraid I will do? And that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers. And are you exhausted at the end of the workday? I will offer a whole panoply of possible solutions. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.